For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and over the next 2 hours we'll be looking back at some of the highlights we've recorded during 2020. Coming up in the first hour, we hitch a ride with an enchanted suitcase and author L.D. Lipinski's Strange Worlds Travel Agency. Husband and wife narrators Alistair Petrie and Lucy Scott reveal how they kept calm and carried on narrating despite lockdown. Blade Runner meets Forrest Gump in Simon Stevenson's android rom-com Set My Heart to Five. And loyal listener Penny Melville Brown shares some of her audiobook highlights of 2020. But first, 2020 started off, as usual, with the annual Costa Book Awards. Only one of the six category winners could be given the title, and for the second year running, the honour went to a historical biography set during the Second World War. In The Volunteer, Jack Fairweather explores the true story of the resistance hero who infiltrated Auschwitz, as I discovered when I interviewed Jack back in January.
The first 8 words of The Volunteer kind of say it all. Witold Pilecki volunteered to be imprisoned in Auschwitz. And yet that's just the beginning of an extraordinary story. Can you tell me a bit more about who Witold Pilecki was?
Sure. Witold Pilecki was, before the war, a gentleman farmer, reserve cavalry officer, living in eastern Poland. And I think one of the amazing things about his story is that but for the German invasion of Poland in September 1939, which kicked off World War II, he would have lived his life quietly with his wife and kids as a farmer. But that invasion by the Germans changed everything, and he was summoned to great deeds. And I think that's one of the things I wanted to explore in the book. How does a seemingly ordinary man go from a quiet life to one of the most extraordinary heroism? And what he went on to do is mind-boggling, as you say. He volunteered for a mission to Auschwitz. A few months after the Germans had invaded Poland, they set up a concentration camp called Auschwitz. And this was intended as part of their plan to destroy the Polish nation. They were sending hundreds and then thousands of Polish citizens to Auschwitz to incarcerate them, spread their reign of terror. The Polish underground that sprang up shortly after the German invasion wanted to find out more. And they turned to Pilecki. He had become a member of the Polish underground at this stage. And they said to him, would you consider getting yourself arrested and sent to Auschwitz to find out what's happening there, to tell the world? And that's the moment of incredible bravery with which I begin the book and dwell upon this man's transformation from a farmer into what, to my mind, is, you know, one of the greatest heroes of World War II.
And he survived 3 years, set up a resistance cell, and there are some amazing stories of derring do. I mean, they really do rival anything that you might have read in the Colditz story, don't they? Could you describe a couple of the most eye-catching?
It is just mind-boggling how he not only survived Auschwitz. So when it opened, it was this incredibly brutal concentration camp. It was yet to become the death factory by which we know Auschwitz today. And that's one of the reasons why his story is so important, because he witnessed the steps by which the Nazis conceived of and implemented the mass murder of Europe's Jews. It was a series of steps, and Pilecki was right there in Auschwitz, stealing SS documents from under their noses, smuggling out reports through incredible escapes. I mean, one that just springs to mind is that 4 prisoners broke into an SS warehouse in the camp, stole SS uniforms there, took Commandant Hirsch's car from his garage, and just drove out of the gates carrying one of Pilecki's warnings to the West. Just mind-boggling bravery. And actually, it was this had a personal angle because one of those escapers was still alive when I began my research, and I got to sit down with him in Gdansk. He was 96, and he talked me through that incredible escape, his knowledge of Paleczki and what it really meant to be a prisoner fighting alongside such an extraordinary man in Auschwitz. There's more. They stole radio parts to set up Radio Auschwitz, which they were broadcasting news of mass murder to the world. They were assassinating SS officers inside Auschwitz. If you're wondering how you do that, they couldn't just kill a German officer because that would lead the SS immediately to reprisals and a crackdown. So instead, they would infect them with lice. Lice were endemic in the camp, and they spread typhus disease. And Paleczki and his men gathered lice together and sprinkled them over the jackets of SS men in their cloakrooms, killing some of the worst mass murderers in history in the process. It's just such a story of courage and bravery. There is a lot of darkness, a lot of evil in the book, but I think when you see it through the eyes of Paleczki, through the eyes of this righteous man and his men, it's just for me at least, it was such a different view of Auschwitz, you know, such a different view of the Holocaust than with this message that yes, you know, we can fight back against the greatest evil.
A soldier stepped out of the dusty car with orders for Witold to gather his men. Poland had ordered a mass mobilization of 500,000 reservists. Witold, a second lieutenant in the cavalry reserves and member of the local gentry, had 48 hours to deliver his unit to the barracks in the nearby town of Lida for loading onto troop transports bound west. He had done his best to train 90 volunteers through the summer, but most of his men were peasants who had never seen action or fired a gun in anger. Several didn't own horses and planned to fight the Germans on bicycle. At least Witold had been able to arm them with Lebel 8mm bolt-action carbines.
David Rintel, narrating The Volunteer, written by Jack Fairweather, which is available commercially.
I am astounded that we have never heard this story before. Is there a reason for that?
There is, and I felt that too. I mean, the first time that someone said to me, have you heard about a resistance cell in Auschwitz? I was sort of dumbstruck because, you know, for me, I think for probably lots of our listeners, you think of Auschwitz as simply the, you know, the greatest evil that man can do to man. And it really tweaked my curiosity, this idea that anyone could fight back against the Nazis in a place like that. And the reason was this. At the end of the war, in May 1945, we all think of that as this great triumph, you know, Hitler defeated, Europe freed. That is not the perspective of so many people in Eastern Europe. You know, May 1945 is celebrated as the end of Nazism, but it was only the beginning of the Soviet takeover of Poland and other countries. And Paleczki, like so many Poles, was faced with a new choice. Should they live under Soviet control, brutal, repressive, led to millions being forced from their homes, lands and property seized, people sent to the gulags, or should they fight back? And I think you can guess what Paleczki chose. He could not countenance living under Soviet control, and he started up resistance work all over again, this time fighting against the communist takeover of Poland. And tragically, he was caught and betrayed and ultimately executed by the communists. And they deleted all trace of his wartime record. In fact, even to speak about it was a crime. His two children never knew about his mission to Auschwitz. So they knew he was in the camp. They didn't know what he got up to then. Neither did his wife. This silence descended on his story. And, you know, I felt, once I realized that, I really felt this injustice and this need to share his story, because this is the story that the communists sought to hide, delete, remove from history. And the reason is simple, because it was so inspiring. Pletsky is such a great sort of symbol of resistance that it was dangerous to their totalitarian regime. And I think, you know, for me, as we look around the world today and we see once again the rise of authoritarianism, of populism, I feel like, you know, Pletsky's story has got something really important to tell us about how to hold to our moral compass in these difficult times.
And does he have any surviving relatives who you were able to bring his story to?
So part of the great joy of the research was discovering that there were so many survivors who remembered Pletsky, in some cases even fought with him. His two children are still alive. His son was the first person I went to see. I was a little bit nervous at the onset of research, arriving in Warsaw, meeting Andrei Pletsky and saying, oh, I've come to write a biography about your dad. But, you know, Andrei is in his mid-80s. He didn't know what his father had done in Auschwitz for decades. In fact, he'd been told repeatedly his dad was an enemy of the people and a traitor. And he is just the most delightful and engaging man who was, you know, thrilled by my interest. He's thrilled to finally have people like recognize his dad as he remembers him, as this great, compassionate man. And I got to spend hours with Andrei. In fact, one of the other elements of the research that I wanted to do was recreate Pletsky's journey as much as possible, which meant following in his footsteps. And one of the things we did was to recreate his escape from the camp. And delightfully, amazingly, Andrei came on some of the escape route with us. He didn't do the sort of 2 a.m. dash from the camp, but he met us at some of the towns and villages along the way. And it was really just the most moving of experiences to be with him in this, for example, monastery where Pletsky sheltered outside during his escape, and having some food there in the same way that Pletsky did all those years before. And it brought home to me the fact that, you know, this is still living memory for so many people, and you can still touch that history. You know, I'm the third generation from World War II, and it's very humbling to meet those who lived through that time, and really reminds me, you know, that every generation has to remember, has to come to terms with what happened.
Well, Jack Fairweather, thank you very much for shining a light on the extraordinary life of Witold Pletsky, and many congratulations on winning this year's Costa Book of the Year Award.
Oh, thank you so much.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss.
For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The helplines open 8 till 8 on weekdays and Saturdays from 9 till 1.
Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
You're listening to a special two-hour edition of Read On, looking back over 2020's Year in Books. Coming up soon, our talking book narrators show how resourceful they are, and an android with a heart. But first,
just imagine if you could climb into your suitcase and be taken to a different world. That's the idea behind a new children's book by author L.D. Lipinski called The Strange Worlds Travel Agency. She joined me over Zoom to tell me all about it.
The Strange Worlds Travel Agency, it's for ages 9 and up, and it's about a girl called Flick who has just moved to a very small, very quiet village from the big city. She goes for a walk around trying to get her bearings, and she comes across an old dusty travel agency, goes inside to take a look, and inside there's lots and lots of stacked up and really sort of abandoned looking suitcases. And one thing leads to another, and she finds out that they're not just ordinary suitcases, they are magical ones, because when you open them and step inside, they take you to other worlds.
Fantastic. And are they other versions of our own world, or are they very different?
Oh, there's a bit of a mixture, actually. One of the worlds she goes to is called Five Lights, and that's a little bit like ours, with some differences. There's some people who use magic spells, for instance, and stealing isn't illegal in that city. It's some people's job. They've got it. They do it as a career. other worlds are completely alien, for want of a better word. There's worlds where the trees are made out of crystal. There's worlds where there's no life at all. It's just landscape. So it really is a mixture of similar and very different worlds to ours.
And Five Lights has a problem, doesn't it?
It does, yes. Five Lights is kind of like the hub at the centre of the multiverse. It's very, very magical. But when Flick and her new friend Jonathan get there, they find some very strange things going on there. There's streets have been disappearing. There's people who have been just dropping out of people's circles entirely. They can't find them. There's strange things going on with the weather. And it's up to Flick and Jonathan to find out why.
And this starts a long quest that takes them to many different worlds. And it's the first book in a series, I believe.
It is, yes. We've just announced the title for the second one. That's going to be called The Strange Worlds Travel Agency, The Edge of the Ocean. And that's coming out next year. And then there's a third book the year after that. So it's ongoing. It's definitely the first of many. The story doesn't end at the end of this first book.
It's a fantastic concept. Where did it come from?
I'm going to be a really annoying person who says, I don't know. It literally came to me out of the blue. I was washing my hair, of all things, and suddenly the travel agency and the suitcases just popped into my head, and I had to dive out of the bathroom like some sort of mad creature, throwing myself into the office. I hadn't even got dry, and wrote the first 10,000 words that morning. It just popped into my head like no idea I've ever had before.
And I can hear the excitement in your voice. Presumably it was great fun to write.
It was amazing fun to write, yeah. But it was very quick as well. It really just poured out. Yeah, and writing the second one as well was really exciting. It's as though the series is a massive book that's been chopped into little chunks. So I get to enjoy myself writing each chunk instead of worrying about having to write a massive book all in one go.
Can you describe the cover of the book for blind and partially sighted listeners who might not be able to see it?
The cover has an open suitcase on the front, and there is a girl who is falling into the suitcase. She's swishing around the page and she's headed towards the suitcase as if she's going to fly inside it. And coming out of the suitcase is a hand reaching out as if to say, come into this suitcase with me. Flick has brown hair and she is 12 years old. And at the top of the book cover is a big red sign, and in gold letters it says The Strange Worlds Travel Agency, which is the same sign that is above the shop in the book.
I know that it's being simultaneously published in print and audio, and you have a rather wonderful narrator.
I do. It's Abigail Hardiman who's doing the narration. She's absolutely fantastic. I can't tell you how pleased I am that you've not got to suffer through me narrating the whole thing. She really is brilliant. I'm so pleased and proud to have her doing the narration.
Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I'd never used to be. I suffer quite poorly with concentrating on things that are delivered audibly. Unfortunately, I'm a much more visual person in general. And I'd never really listened to a great many audiobooks until I just finished reading La Belle Sauvage, the first book in the Book of Dust trilogy. And I was absolutely obsessed with it. And I was walking through my local library with a tote bag with the book cover on the front. And the librarian bustled up to me and said, have you seen, we've just got the audiobook of this in. And I felt like saying, well, I don't really read audiobooks. But she seemed so enthusiastic that I took it home anyway and sat and listened to it. And then it was like an epiphany, like I have been missing out on so much good storytelling. I'd forgotten how nice it is to be read to, and now I'm such a fan.
Yes, and more people, I think, are finding that audiobooks are terrific companions during these times of lockdown. And, of course, the idea of climbing into a suitcase and being whisked away to different worlds has never been so tempting. It's strange timing for your publication, but I'm sure thousands of children will love travelling with the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's something even my anxiety didn't anticipate, having my debut book come out during a global pandemic. And I do hope that children and readers do use it as an escapism and do jump into other worlds with the book. Escapism in stories and novels has always been the big selling point for me, whether that's in books or video games or TV. Anything to take me away from current affairs in general has always been what I've looked for in stories. And as you say, I think now more than ever, getting away from what's going on is going to be really important.
L.D. Lipinski, thank you so much for introducing us to the Strange Worlds Travel Agency and for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners. I'll look forward to welcoming you back when you publish the sequel.
Thank you so much. I'd love to be back. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to L.D. Lipinski. The Strange Worlds Travel Agency is out now commercially in print, ebook, and audio, narrated by Abigail Hardiman.
You're listening to a special two-hour edition of Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. And now, a book can only become an audiobook with the help of a narrator, or two. But what happens when the recording studios are closed? The Talking Book Studios have always employed actors to bring titles to life, many of whom feel passionate about the work that they do. Husband and wife team Alistair Petrie and Lucy Scott are no exception. They're stars of stage and screen and keen supporters of the RNIB Library.
Yeah, it's such an amazing resource. What's really struck me recently with the circumstances we find ourselves in is the access and the need that we really have at the moment for stories. And I've thought a lot about this over the last sort of few weeks, that, you know, it's a confusing time, this whole sort of COVID-19 that everyone is going through, and having access to stories and a plentiful amount of stories is also very important, stories being so crucial to our lives and how stories sort of help us understand the world in which we live, to make sense of the world in which we live. And I think we could all argue quite merrily at the moment that the world in which we find ourselves living is so extraordinary and so confusing, and there's a lot coming at us. And I think it gives us huge amounts of comfort as well. It gives us time away from our own thought processes, which is, I think, incredibly healthy. It feeds into our imaginations, and all of these things are in existence throughout our normal lives and in our very abnormal lives, which we're finding ourselves at the moment. It's never been more important, that access to stories.
Have you managed to record at all since the lockdown?
I have. In fact, we set up, it looks like a five-year-old's den made out of mattresses and blankets and rugs in a spare room with a nice mic. And we've been crawling into this little den and actually recording. I recorded something for the RNIB, The Umbrella Mouse, set in the Second World War, where one of the engineers, Pinky, I'd sent him all my raw audio and he would clean it up his end. And Al's also recorded a play, a Big Finish production.
Yeah, a Doctor Who play, which was really fun. And hopefully this lockdown won't go on for a huge while longer, and we can get back to doing what we do best and where we do it best at.
So we do feel lucky that we
can. We do. We have the capacity to do it. And thanks to Lucy's technical skills and my ability to point at things, the studio, sort of home-based studio, has been created. So we are very much up and running, and would dearly, as ever, love to do more. But there's no substitute for going in to record on-site in studio. It feeds more into the work in many ways. And I think in life we look for community, and I think that's exactly what the RNIB offers. It's the strength of community, and that's not only people that access the service, but the people that sort of contribute to the Talking Book service as well. It's all part of the same community.
But it's wonderful to know that that community spirit is all pulling together to ensure that books are still being recorded, to ensure that we do still manage to get programmes out on the radio station. And of course, the new RNIB Online Reading Services Library has just been launched, which means that people can just download them immediately onto their phones and their computers and listen to, well, you, Lucy, reading Northanger Abbey by Jane Austen.
Hooray! Yeah. That's so wonderful to hear from our end.
That's good news. I think the technical aspect is so important, the immediacy of people able to just sort of click and collect and not have to wait is just fantastic. So access is key, and the more access the better. And now sort of immediately downloadable, you can have a thought in your head, I want to listen to that. Is it available? Yes, it is. I can start in 30 seconds, and that is just wonderful.
From all those books that you've both narrated, do you both have favourites that have really stuck with you?
It's not particularly a favourite, but it's one that's really memorable, is when Al and I recorded something together, and it was the entire Guinness World Records book. We read it cover to cover. He read one new record, I read the next new record, and it took us about a week.
What was so memorable about it in many ways was that we sort of went through an entire spectrum of being totally awestruck at certain human achievements, to be massively irritated by
one man
who decided to gain as many world records as he could. Well, a creator world record that really didn't need creating. So how many baked beans could you balance on a cocktail stick?
Yes. Running 100 metres in a pair of fins.
Yeah, I think he carries, I don't know, a few dozen. And instead of going, well done, was just deeply irritating. But good luck to him, why not? I'm sure he's going to come up with a lot more, given that he's got a lot of time on his hands. But I think personally, that there were sort of two, really. The first one, which I was very touched by for a variety of reasons, was Blood and Sand, the Frank Gardner book, the BBC security correspondent who was shot in Saudi Arabia. And I've never forgotten it. The other one I really enjoyed for more of a sort of a daring do way was Long Way Round, the Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman book about their motorbike trip around the world and all of the things that they got up to. And as a piece of adventure, it was a terrific read. And I do love those stories of very serious human endeavour, but also the lighthearted notion as well. I guess maybe I should have been a tepid explorer in a past life, although I hate camping, so that probably wouldn't have worked.
And you, Lucy?
I really enjoy multi-voice reads. There was a lovely Jacqueline Wilson book called Twins, and I read it with Rachel Atkins, and it just makes it so enlivening having somebody else read it with you. Also, something I really did enjoy was Mr. Pip by Lloyd Jones, who's I think he's a New Zealand journalist, but it was a piece of fiction set in Papua New Guinea during a civil war. And it was from the point of view of a young girl. The whole educational structure, well, the whole infrastructure had collapsed. And the only person that remained on the island to teach them was this old guy. The only thing that he could teach them was about Great Expectations. So she, within the book, disappeared off into another book, which was Victorian England. And that sort of took her away from the horrors of where she was in Papua New Guinea. It's a beautiful book. I think they made it into a film with Hugh Laurie. Anyway, really, really lovely. The only trouble is, if you're reading in the first person, you think, how am I going to read this young girl? Shall I read her with an accent? Or I started off reading her with an accent, and then I started realizing that it was impossible. So after 50 pages, I had to start all over again.
that's the classic narrator's terror.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, if you don't prepare, you can...
Because I really wanted to get it right. I wanted to do a really good job, and I realised I was doing a terrible job.
You've mentioned that you've worked once together before on the Guinness Book of World Records. Is there a book that you would push all the other narrators out of the way to narrate together?
Yes, gosh, there's one I would love to do with Lucy. I think it feeds into the thing that Lucy mentioned about sort of multi-voices, really, is His Dark Materials, the Philip Pullman trilogy. There's obviously lots to get into. It's three vast and wonderful books. But I did that as a stage production at the National Theatre about, gosh, 15, 16 years ago. But I think it would be an amazing journey to take with Lucy through the worlds and the existences that the characters go through. I would love to do something epic like that. We did spend a week doing the Guinness Book of World Records, and we didn't fall out.
No, we still smiled at each other.
we were across a table as well, so it was a sort of a unique working method as well. We sort of sat opposite each other. That was really, really enjoyable working together on that.
And Lucy, is there a book that you've got your eye on?
I do love books with dialogue and character. I mean, Jane Austen writes such beautiful characters, and I do love them, and I'd always love to revisit, and there's some beautiful characters in there.
I think Dickens as well would be amazing, yeah, to dive into the structure of Dickens' storytelling. Obviously, the vast array of characters, a lot of them very heightened characters as well, so one could really play with those. I think we would have a ball. In fact, I'm sure whoever was producing and engineering the book would be constantly telling us to calm down, which is always tricky to do with actors. But yeah, so classics, really.
Although Al once read a book about the story of the Queen Anne. Anyway, he had one scene where he had a conversation.
Yeah, Lady Jane.
Lady Jane, yeah. Grey, that's it. And he had a conversation that he had to have with himself, effectively, where one of the characters was from the West Country and another character was from North Norfolk. And that was almost an impossibility.
It was the ultimate challenge. if you call it the climbing of Mount Everest for a narrator, I think that may have been it. Getting lost in a snowstorm of accents in the death zone, that's where I got.
So Star Wars is easy in comparison to working for the RNIB Talking Book Studios, then?
Star Wars is comparatively easy. Yes, I'd much rather try and save the Rebel Alliance rather than have a conversation between someone from North Norfolk and someone from the West Country. Yeah, saving the galaxy 10 times easier.
Well, you heard it here first on RNIB Connect Radio. Well, Lucy Scott and Alistair Petrie, thank you so much.
Such a pleasure. And I just wanted to highlight one thing that Lucy said that really struck me, and it's a phrase I haven't heard before, and maybe I probably should have done. The glory of the RNIB Talking Book Service is that it really does offer a theatre for one. I think that's a really wonderful description of what the service can offer. It's way more than just reading a book, and it is such a pleasure to do. So thank you, RNIB.
Yes, thank you so much for including us.
Well, I look forward to seeing you both back in the green room at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Camden when all this gets back to normal. But in the meanwhile, thank you so much for all the hard work that you've done in bringing books to life for people like me who can't read print anymore, and for coming onto the show to talk about your life in talking books.
A very big pleasure, Red. Thank you.
A complete pleasure, Red.
Thanks again to Lucy and Alistair. For a full list of the many titles that they've narrated, and for more information about the RNIB Reading Services Library, go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
It's not difficult to donate a little to RNIB. In fact, it's as easy as treating yourself to the latest CD, digital device, or Amazon Echo. Raise money for RNIB whilst you shop at Amazon. Amazon Smile is a simple and automatic way for you to support RNIB every time you shop, at no cost to you. When you next sign in to Amazon, use the address www.smile.amazon.co.uk. and nominate RNIB as your charity of choice. The webpage looks exactly like amazon.co.uk, and it remembers all of your login details, order history, wish lists, wedding lists, etc. But importantly, RNIB will receive 0.5% of the net sale of most goods that you can buy on the site. It's that easy to donate. Tell your friends and family how simple it is to donate to RNIB every time you shop on Amazon, simply by using www.smile.amazon.co.uk. Treat yourself on Amazon and support your favourite charity while you shop.
Welcome back to this Read On retrospective of 2020. Back in May, we heard about a book on its way to becoming a Hollywood movie.
Every so often, I get a press release for a book that makes me go, I've got to read that, which is exactly what happened with Set My Heart to Five by Simon Stevenson. It's his debut novel, and he joined me from his home in Los Angeles, where he's already working on the screenplay for what promises to be a major new film. So, Simon, rather than my telling the audience what the book's about, why don't you?
Set My Heart to Five is the story of an android called Jared. And if you're not a science fiction person by default, which I have to confess I amn't exactly, an android tends to be a human-type body with a computer-type brain. My book is set in 2054, at a time when we do have androids and they're human bodies, and someone's just realized that with all the fancy new DNA technology, the CRISPR technology, to really make a good android, all you have to do is take the DNA for a human brain and take out the bit that codes for consciousness and replace it with the source code for Windows 95. And then you would have a programmable android who will do whatever you like. Of course, being humans, we are going to make the androids do all the jobs that we don't want to do. The narrator of the book is a dentist. Androids will be wonderful dentists because they don't have any empathy. So they're not going to be put off if you're complaining or crying or screaming. The android will get that wisdom tooth out every time. Being humans, though, we're, of course, naturally very protective of ourselves. And the one advantage that we have over artificial intelligence is that we have feelings and they don't. So in this future world of 2054, anytime an android starts to show any hint of feelings, we either wipe them or incinerate them. We swiftly get rid of them. So Jared lives in the American Midwest and he's just doing his tasks, doing his dentistry. And one day he starts to have what seem to be feelings. That sets him off on a journey and adventure to try and save himself and others like him. And one of the key things that helps him understand feelings and learn to feel is movies. So he watches a lot of old movies.
And through films, Jared begins to discover feelings within himself. And this sparks a road trip and a chase across the United States.
Yes. So in 2054, the organization who are charged with managing androids and making sure that they don't have feelings is a department called the Bureau of Robotics. The central joke around the Bureau of Robotics is that they're much like the Department of Motor Vehicles, the DMV here in the US, who are notoriously slow and incompetent and nothing ever happens when it should. If you ever saw the movie Zootopia, there's a scene where the animal characters go to the DMV and everyone working there is portrayed by sloths, and it's just everything moves in incredibly slow motion. So the Bureau of Robotics was kind of inspired by the DMV in the, you know, they're very slow moving, but nonetheless, they do have this terrible power and threat over Jared. So the world in 2054, as I've imagined it, is sort of all too human. It's not a dystopia. I've been calling it a mystopia. So it's much like our current world, except things are just mostly a bit worse. For instance, there's been a terrible data loss event, a great crash. But the reason why that's occurred is because, you know how when you forget your email password, and then it sends it to your old recovery email account. And then it asks you who your favorite teacher was and who your first pet was. Basically, on a critical day in 2037, a critical mass of humans forgot the names of their first teacher and their beloved first pet. And it led to the entirety of humanity being forever locked out of the internet. So in 2054, we live in a strange world where we have some new technology like androids, but equally we lack a lot of things. So we don't really have planes anymore because planes all fell out of the sky when the internet crashed and the airlines are all still suing each other to work out who's liable. And that's the world Jared kind of comes of age in. And then the other thing to say is the movies that he watches, of course, they have killer robot sagas, but he doesn't want to watch those movies because he's a robot himself. So he's not very into that. And actually, the movies that have become classics are the movies that I kind of grew up on. So the movies of the 80s and 90s, really, which obviously have their flaws. But the one thing they always have, I think, is they're always big-hearted. So I'm thinking about movies like Big or Forrest Gump or Sleepless in Seattle. I realize I've just named three Tom Hanks movies there. I think maybe that's part of the point is, you know, he is always very good at doing the heart in the movies, isn't he? So our android Jared ultimately tries to teach humans that androids like him should be allowed to feel.
And something that really comes through both in your voice and from the press release is it's a funny book. It's a satirical book, but with a big heart that explores what it is to be human.
I think that's really the hope. Absolutely, Red. I mean, I'm always so cautious of saying, you know, when people say, describe your book. And of course, I want to say, well, it's funny. But funny is so subjective, isn't it? That, like, I'm always nervous of claiming it's funny. But I hope people find it funny. Other people have found it funny. A lot of that is cohesive with my basic take on the world, that there's a lot of terrible stuff in the world, but sometimes you have to laugh, right? And so, for instance, in the book, there's no longer a moon by 2054 because Elon Musk incinerated it. He incinerated it in, you know, what at the time he believed was a hilarious prank, but what he now says was an accident, which seems about right. At the rate we're going, these things which I wrote as comic satire, you're sort of like, well, but sure, why not? Like, that could easily happen in the next 20 years.
Are you a big fan of satire?
Satire is a funny word, isn't it? Because when I think of satire, and I don't know if it's just, you know, growing up in the 1980s, but I think of something like Spitting Image, which was hilarious, but was really kind of, I think satire has a really strong element of mockery in it sometimes. And I'm definitely really interested in emotion and heart and feelings. And I think the best of both worlds is if you can be funny, but then also hopefully try and bring some heart and some feelings as well, because I think as humans, we like both those things. And I don't like reading things that are kind of mean-spirited, and definitely that's not what I try and write. I think the danger with satire sometimes is that you can trip over into that territory.
And I suppose that's what Jared is actually looking for, the meaning in life, the emotions that make people tick.
Exactly. And I think so much of that is drawn from personal experience. I wrote the book at a time when I was living by myself in a new city. The relationship I'd been in had ended. And so I was feeling quite isolated. And Jared has this thing where he kind of yearns for human connection. He wants to be amongst people and he wants to be included in things. But yet he doesn't quite know how to do it. He doesn't know the right thing to say, and he worries about saying the wrong thing. And, you know, as a sometime lonely introvert myself, even though he's an android, I think what I've tried to do is give him some very recognizable human things that maybe a lot of us can relate to.
By your accent, you're a Scot currently living in Los Angeles. And I think you are the first author I have spoken to who, even before the book has been published, is working on the screenplay for the Hollywood movie version. And you're working with another expat, I believe, Edgar Wright, who famously created Shaun of the Dead and Baby Driver.
Yes, absolutely. So I got incredibly lucky in that my day job for the past years has been as a screenwriter. So I worked on something with Edgar's producers. And when I finished the manuscript of the book, I emailed them and, you know, asked if they might be interested to read. And I knew it was the longest shot in the world because he's such a wonderful filmmaker and we're all his great fan. And I'm sure he gets inundated with books all the time. But they liked it and they passed it to him and he liked it. And suddenly there was a potential movie version. And I think in hindsight, it's a great thing as a screenwriter to write the book, because then you kind of fairly automatically get the job to write the script as well. So normally what would happen with a project that had a big director like Edgar Wright involved, I mean, he tends to write himself anyway, and he's a brilliant writer. But if you're working with someone of that caliber, what would tend to happen would be the studio would go out to 12 writers and you would all have to schlep into the studio and go and pitch your take on it. And you'd spend weeks working up your pitch, and then you'd go and invariably I wouldn't get the job. And so actually writing the book first to mean that you get the job to write the screenplay seems like a much better model to me from this distance.
And have you got anybody in mind for the part of Jared?
I actually don't. So it's funny, sometimes I caught myself doing that when I've written other things. And I think it's a little bit dangerous because I think you end up writing whatever the stereotype of that actor is. Like, I always say that I adore the English actor Bill Nighy. I think he's wonderful. But I think that at a certain point, like, writers now probably they don't even make up a character name. They probably just put Bill Nighy in the script because he just comes in and has to play a very similar person. So I try and steer away from that. And then I think the other thing to say is, as the writer, you don't really get a say in that. Like, that's really the director's call. I think there's lots of people who do it wonderfully in truth. And I'm kind of just really excited to see if and when it happens, how they do it.
But he would be more likely to be a Simon Pegg than an Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Perhaps, yeah. I think in the book, Jared is in his 40s, and part of the thing with androids is that they're created to be as ordinary and as non-offensive as possible. So yeah, they don't really look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. They probably do look more like Simon Pegg. He's definitely not the Terminator. He's more just a very ordinary human.
And in the meantime, the book has been brought to life as an audiobook.
Hi, my name is Jared. I am sincerely pleased to meet you. Also, I am a bot. Unless you have been living under a rock in North Korea or New Zealand, ha, you of course know what a bot is. Nonetheless, I am programmed to relay the following dialogue to each new human I encounter. Please do not be fooled by my human-like appearance. I am a mere bot. I do not have feelings or anything else that might be misconstrued as a soul. Instead, I have been programmed to a high level of proficiency in dentistry. Should you have any concerns, please immediately report me to the Bureau of Robotics. But humans rarely find this information calming. Instead, they see a fellow human standing in front of them claiming that he is not a human. This bamboozles them. It often bamboozles them so profoundly that they exclaim, "But you look so human." I then patiently explain to them what they anyway already know, that my body looks human because it is indeed a human body. It is engineered from DNA and constructed of cells the exact same way their own body is. It has the same basic needs: food, water, oxygen, regular exercise, and it can be injured or killed in all the same comically outlandish ways any other human body can. Yet I am definitely not human. Because the precious thing that sets humans apart is their feelings. And, as a bot, I am specifically designed and programmed to be incapable of feelings. I can no more feel than a toaster, ha! BTW, that is a hilarious joke, because the programming language I run on was in fact first developed many years ago for use in the domestic toaster.
Christopher Ragland, narrating Set My Heart to Five, written by Simon Stevenson, which is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
RNIB is helping people with sight loss keep up to date during the coronavirus pandemic by offering a free subscription to a newspaper or broadcast guide via its news agent service. RNIB News Agent provides plain text email versions of major UK newspapers and TV and radio guides, which can be easily read with magnification or screen reading software. This offer means that anyone who finds it difficult to read a paper or TV guide in their current print or online formats can get easy access to their favourite publication for free for up to 3 months. We would like to acknowledge the support of NLA Media Access for helping us to provide this. For a full list of what publications are available from RNIB Newsagent, or to sign up to the service, call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 or email helpline@rnib.org.uk. RNIB, standing with you through every challenge.
And now, to round off this first hour looking back at 2020 on Read On, here's one of our loyal listeners who's got a prodigious appetite for audiobooks.
Penny Melville Brown is a retired naval officer and the founder of Disability Dynamics and Baking Blind, both of which seek to highlight the capabilities of blind and other disabled people. She's also an avid consumer of audiobooks. Here she is to tell us what she's been reading recently.
Thank you, Red. Well, I thought I'd start off with quite a modern book, because some of the others are rather older. And this is Police by Joe Nesbø. And he is a Norwegian author who writes about the police in Oslo. His character is Harry Holler, who is struggling with alcoholism, with corruption and power play within the police force, with his love life, and just generally not having a great time. But he's a thoroughly endearing character, and I've been following him through about 10 books now. And Police is one of the latest I've read, and it's where he comes into confrontation with the chief of police, who is a very nasty character, and I strongly recommend it. It's pretty violent in places, but it's a great read.
It was suddenly so quiet he could hear the final, almost transparent drops dripping into the cup. There was no more colour or taste to be had from the capsule, but it was vital to catch every last droplet. It was going to be a long night shift for the young woman. Without any company, without any action, without anything to do, other than to stare at the inside of the Rijkshospital's unpainted, bare concrete walls. Then he decided he would have a coffee with her before leaving. He took both cups with him and returned. His footsteps resounded against the walls. He passed closed, locked doors, knowing there was nothing or no one behind them, only more bare walls. For once, Norway had built for the future with the Rijkshospital, realizing that Norwegians were becoming more numerous, aged, infirm, and needy. They had taken a long-term approach, the way the Germans had with their autobahns and the Swedes with their airports.
Sean Barrett narrating Police by Joe Nesbo, which is available commercially. Other titles in the Harry Holler series are available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
My next book that I'm reading, and I can't even tell you the end of this because I've only just started it. It is John Galsworthy's The Country House, and it's very upstairs, downstairs. So we're starting with all these highfalutin guests arriving at the station for their country house visit. And the footmen and the carriage driver are on the platform ready to greet them. And they're all sort of exchanging ideas about, oh, that one's not very good, he doesn't tip. And you can see the whole thing starting to move forward with these characters and how they have hijinks in the country house. A bit of naughtiness is obviously going on in the bedrooms and the servants are watching what's going on. I really enjoy John Galsworthy, and people might remember him from the Forsyte Saga, which was on television decades and decades ago, but is a really good series of books, what I think are nowadays called historical family sagas. And they are all about the commercial life, the lawyerly life in the sort of late part of the 19th century. What I love about listening to these books, and it's so much better than trying to read them yourself, because often when you've got the printed page in front of you, some of these books are incredibly dense. They don't have many paragraph breaks. They don't have any dialogue. I don't know whether you ever tried to read Anthony Trollope, and he's wonderful for the Barsetshire series and the Palliser series, both of which have again been on television. But having them read to you brings the whole story alive, the characters alive, and you suddenly get the sense of humour that you miss when you're reading the printed page.
On the platform within, Mr. Horace Pendice's first footman and second groom in long livery coats with silver buttons, their appearance slightly relieved by the rakish cock of their top hats, awaited the arrival of the 6:15. The first footman took from his pocket a half-sheet of stamped and crested notepaper, covered with Mr. Horace Pendice's small and precise calligraphy. He read from it, in a nasal, derisive voice, "On Jeff and Mrs. Winlow, blue room and dress. Maid, small drab. Mr. George, white room. Mrs. Jasper Bellew, gold. The captain, red. General Pendice, pink room. Valley back attic. That's the lot." The groom, a red-cheeked youth, paid no attention.
Maurice Turner narrating The Country House by John Galsworthy, which is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
My final choice is, again, what I'm reading at the moment, and I spend the whole time listening to books when I'm cooking, when I'm wandering around the house, when I'm swimming. I just listen to books all the time, probably reading at least three a week. And this one is Smiley's People by John le Carré. And I probably read it at least five times before. And it's all about spies in the Cold War era, back in the 1960s, 70s, 80s. And for me, it's very reminiscent of the work I was doing at the time when I was in Naples in the Navy doing NATO intelligence. And when I came back and I was doing planning for home defense and war, and nuclear strike was a real possibility. So I love these books because not so much the stories, which are excellent in their own way, but it's the characters. And George Smiley is the absolute antithesis of James Bond. It's where somebody with subtlety, sensitivity, intellect is really able to do the intelligence job. It's all about brains rather than daring do. And that's reflected again. And I don't know whether your listeners will have heard of Len Dayton's 9 novels of all about Bernie Sampson. Again, another spy in the late 20th century, a man of character and subtlety. So I love books like this because they're quite thrilling. And I read for escapism because my life is incredibly busy. And so when I read, I like to just take my brain completely out of day-to-day stuff and go somewhere else and meet different people.
Two seemingly unconnected events heralded the summons of Mr. George Smiley from his dubious retirement. The first had for its background Paris, and for a season, the boiling month of August, when Parisians, by tradition, abandon their city to the scalding sunshine and the busloads of packaged tourists. On one of these August days, the 4th, and at 12 o'clock exactly, for a church clock was chiming and a factory bell had just preceded it, in a quartier once celebrated for its large population of the poorer Russian émigré, a stocky woman of about 50, carrying a shopping bag, emerged from the darkness of an old warehouse and set off, full of her usual energy and purpose, along the pavement to the bus stop.
Andrew Timothy, narrating Smiley's People by John le Carré, available from the RNIB Talking Books Library. Penny, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading, and I hope you'll come back onto the show in a few weeks' time to update us with what new books you've been diving into.
Red, I'd love to. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Penny. And if you'd like to share the books that you've been enjoying, why not drop us a line? The address is radio@rnib.org.uk.
And Read On will be back with more highlights from 2020 after the news.